This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, November 23, 2005. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Auda Bogado. Ahmed Omar Abu Ali is convicted on charges that he planned to assassinate George Bush. Thousands of people gather in a 14-acre community food garden to resist eviction at the hands of development. And Native American tribes gather to expose a different view of Thanksgiving. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Brian Edwards Tiegert with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. British Prime Minister Tony Blair's government has ordered a London newspaper to stop publishing articles about an abandoned U.S. plan to attack the headquarters of Arab satellite TV station Al Jazeera. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
Yesterday, London's Daily Mirror newspaper broke an explosive story. It reported that in April 2004, US President George W. Bush was planning to attack Al Jazeera's headquarters in Doha, Qatar. But Tony Blair talked him out of it. The report was based on a top-secret transcript of conversations alleged to have taken place between the two leaders. Daily Mirror editor Richard Wallace says the paper told the government it would publish details of the conversations between Blair and Bush, but received no response. Now, 24 hours after the first article came out, the government has threatened the Daily Mirror with prosecution under Britain's Official Secrets Act if they reveal anything further from the memo. It's the first time Tony Blair's government has threatened a newspaper in this way. Two people are already facing prosecution for the leak. A Foreign Office official and a researcher who worked for former anti-war MP Tony Clark. The Attorney General has charged them both with making a damaging disclosure of a document relating to international relations. The International Federation of Journalists is demanding complete disclosure from the US and British governments, citing the 16 uninvestigated deaths of media personnel at the hands of US forces in Iraq. Members of Parliament from Britain's main political parties have launched another effort to force an independent inquiry into the conduct of the Iraq invasion and occupation. Tony Blair has so far refused to comment. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
In Chile, a judge has indicted former dictator Augusto Pinochet on charges of fraud, forgery, and corruption. From Santiago, Jorge Garretón has more.
Prosecuting judge Carlos Cerda ordered Pinochet's arrest after announcing his prosecution on four counts of tax evasion, falsifying official documents, the use of fake passports, and for failing to declare earnings. The 89-year-old Pinochet will remain under house arrest until the trial ends. Judge Cerda set bail at 12 million pesos or nearly $23,000. This case came to light after a U.S. Senate investigation found that Pinochet held secret accounts in the Washington-based Riggs Bank. It is estimated Pinochet amassed some $27 million illegally. Prosecuting attorney Carmen Hertz, who has filed charges against Pinochet in several cases.
He should have assumed responsibility a long time ago, not just in this fraud case, but for his criminal extermination policies. He has never done so. He continues to show that he is simply and sadly a coward.
Pinochet, who will turn 90 this Friday, has avoided trial in two human rights cases. Because of his health, earlier this month, he was deemed fit to stand trial. He still faces charges of killing 15 people in the so-called Operation Colombo case. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
In the Chinese city of Harbin, nearly 4 million people have had their water shut off as a massive chemical spill approaches on the Songhua River. City authorities initially told residents the water was shut off for repairs. Yesterday, they admitted the shutoff was sparked by pollution concerns and warned residents to stay away from the river because the gases evaporating off it could be hazardous. The slow-moving spill originates 240 miles upstream, where a November 13 explosion at a petrochemical plant killed at least five people and forced the evacuation of 10,000 more. The principal concern is benzene, a chemical that causes nerve damage, cancer, and leukemia. When last measured, benzene levels in the river were still nearly 30 times higher than Chinese safety limits. Agence France-Presse is reporting that the chemical spill has already passed two large cities without government warnings or warnings. water shutoffs. They have a combined population of nearly 3.5 million. Israel's outgoing housing minister has approved the construction of more housing units in the occupied West Bank. Manar Jabrin has more.
Housing Minister Yitzhak Herzog, a member of the Labour Party, has approved 350 new housing units for Maali Adumim. Herzog said he made the decision in consultation with Amir Peretz, the newly elected leader of his party. The expansion is seen as a move to attract more right-wing Israeli voters to the Labour Party in elections scheduled for March. Dr. Jad Ishaq, director of Applied Research Center and Settlement Issues expert, said that Israel will implement its plans despite U.S. objection.
They would implement part of the E1 plan, despite the American objection that we heard last month when the critical statement from the U.S. administration that the E1 plan should not go ahead.
Notably, both the newly elected leader of the Labour Party and the outgoing Israeli Prime Minister Sharon shared the goal of expanding settlement blocks in the West Bank. That's a violation of both international law and the U.S.-backed roadmap for peace. For FSR and from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
The state of Massachusetts has brokered a deal with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to secure low-cost heating oil for the state's poor. Citgo Petroleum, a company controlled by the Venezuelan government, will supply more than 12 million gallons of home heating oil at a cost 40% below market prices. The offer was seen as an attempt to embarrass the Bush administration, which Chavez has accused of plotting to overthrow him. I'm Brian Edward Steekert for Free Speech Radio News.
A settlement in federal court yesterday effectively stopped the mass evictions taking place in the New Orleans metropolitan area. As part of a settlement, the Federal Emergency Management Agency has agreed to deliver the addresses of tenants who have been evacuated to local government officials so that they can send eviction notices by mail and extend the time for eviction hearings from 3 to 45 days. FSRN's Christian Roseland reports from New Orleans.
FEMA said that they was going to give up some information. FEMA, this is not happening with FEMA anywhere else.
Ishmael Muhammad of the Grassroots Legal Network, a plaintiff in the case, was ecstatic after yesterday's court settlement. FEMA has long been seen as a Goliath in court proceedings and has refused to share any information on the whereabouts of the displaced with other agencies. The agency also denied funding in October to notify evacuees that they could vote in the February mayoral election. Tenants' rights activists say that they have seen hundreds of evictions every day in court after Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco released a hold on serving evictions late last month. Muhammad says that these evictions are changing the race and class composition of the city.
This notice process has become a way to get rid of the poor community of New Orleans, to get rid of the Black community in New Orleans, to get rid of the Voices community of New Orleans, because they don't see them as being effectively able to respond to this onslaught on them. But it's a campaign being raised to gentrify the city. It's a campaign being raised to reserve the housing opportunities for those who fit a certain class bracket, who fit a certain race bracket, and that's the politic of the day in New Orleans.
Louisiana rental law is among the most landlord-friendly in the nation. Muhammad says the court agreed that these laws are not appropriate under these circumstances.
They're not here to fight. And through a mechanism that doesn't even allow them the opportunity to fight, that mechanism being basically being able to go to a tenant's residence, put a notice on their door, even though you know they've been evacuated, even though you know that they have no reason to be checking in on this city, which is not up and running, where there are no jobs, where there are no schools, where there are no services in many parts of the city. These landlords that are utilizing a law that was suspect in this application even before Katrina clearly is a problem during this post-Katrina environment.
FEMA made another concession yesterday, saying that it will continue to pay the hotel bills of evacuees until January 7th in the 10 states with the most displaced persons, and December 15th everywhere else. The previous deadline had been December 1st. Despite these victories, Jeremy Prickett, a tenant organizer with the New Orleans Housing Emergency Action Team, says his group is expecting evictions to continue through other means.
We have to expect a sharp increase in illegal evictions. because there's too much money at stake for landlords that have units that they want to rent out at higher rents to wait 45 days. And what I expect to see is a sharp increase in locks being changed and property being tossed out without any legal process. I was approached last night by one of my neighbors whose lock had been changed while he was at work yesterday, and I think it was right after this decision was public. So our project of building a community response to illegal evictions is speeding up as a result of this hearing.
For Free Speech Radio News in New Orleans, this is Christian Roseland.
As we reported yesterday, Jose Padilla, who has been incarcerated for the past 3 years, was indicted on several charges, but none of which are based on his detention as an enemy combatant. Padilla, a U.S. citizen, spent 3 years in an army brig in South Carolina with very limited access to a lawyer and without any charges filed against him. Padilla's indictment is seen as a way for the Bush administration to avoid possible embarrassment with the Supreme Court, which ruled in 2004 that it was unconstitutional to hold U.S. citizen Yasser Hamdi as an enemy combatant. Meanwhile, a federal jury convicted 24-year-old Falls Church, Virginia native Ahmed Omar Abu Ali Tuesday on charges that include conspiracy to assassinate the president and providing support to al-Qaeda. FSRN's Selena Masuta has more.
The jurors that convicted Ahmed Omar Abu Ali said that a videotape provided by the prosecution that shows Ali confessing to plotting the murder of President George W. Bush convinced them of his guilt. But Ali, who was arrested in June 2003 in Saudi Arabia while pursuing religious studies, contends that he was tortured into falsely confessing by Saudi officials. Ali's lawyers plan to appeal the case. Mehdi Bray of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation has been working on Ali's case from day one.
The evidence was very, very convincing that Abu Ali had been tortured. There were both physical signs, there were photographs, as well as there was forensic evidence by a physical examination both by the director of the Torture Center in New York, as well as a physician who verified clearly that Abu Ali had been beaten while he was in Saudi Arabia.
Medical experts for the prosecution testified that their findings on whether or not Ali was tortured were inconclusive. Many in Northern Virginia's close-knit Arab-American community believe that Arabs and Muslims cannot face a fair trial in the United States. Several months ago, while Ali was detained in Saudi Arabia, members of Northern Virginia's Arab American community met with the second-in-command of the Federal Bureau of Investigation's Washington Bureau. Founding Director of Peace Through Justice, Maurice Salakan, attended the meeting.
This man said before an audience of Muslims that he didn't understand why Ahmed Abu Ali was still being held in Saudi Arabia. This was several months before he was brought back to the States. Why he was still being held. They were doing everything that they could to get him back into the States. Our government didn't have any charges against him. But as soon as the family was successful through a federal lawsuit in forcing the government to bring an American citizen back home, that's when our government brought charges against him.
Ali's sentencing hearing is set for February the 17th. Selena Masuta, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
Cuban President Fidel Castro has called on the Bush administration to make a statement on how Cuban-American international terrorist Luis Posada Carriles managed to enter the United States illegally. Now, the man suspected by Cuba of arranging Posada Carriles' trip to Miami has been arrested by the FBI. Joseph Muti reports from Havana.
The arrest of business entrepreneur Santiago Alvarez took place after Fidel Castro alluded to his role in Posada's illegal entry into the United States. A full-page ad demanding the extradition of Posada Carriles to Venezuela appeared in the New York Times on Friday. Along with a Miami resident named Orlando Bosch, Luis Posada Carriles was charged by Caracas as the intellectual author of the bombing of a Cuban airliner in 1976 with the loss of all on board. He was also recently tried and convicted of possession of bomb-making equipment in a case involving an attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro during a visit to Panama in 2000. The Cuban leader has previously said that protecting a man such as Posada Carriles would be an insult to the memory of the victims of the September 11th attack. High school student Yoilime Leon agrees.
Bueno, yo pienso que esta detención es una parte importante, o sea, que es una importante victoria para Cuba.
Well, I think this arrest is an important victory for Cuba. It proves that the Bush administration is utterly hypocritical regarding terrorism against Cuba. From the start, it was clear that Alvarez had assisted in the return of this assassin, Posada Carriles, to Miami.
Daryl Myers, who participates in the Free the Five campaign in San Francisco, which seeks the release of five Cubans whose sentences were recently reversed by a three-judge panel of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, agrees.
I think the arrest of Alvarez indicates the growing pressure and an awareness on the part of governments and people all over the world that the United States government is incredibly hypocritical in its so-called war on terrorism. It illustrates the hypocrisy of the United States government, that the same FBI which arrested five Cuban patriots who were working diligently and courageously against terrorism against their own country, that same FBI boasts of being, you know, the leading force against terrorism. I can't say how glad I am that they're being forced to prosecute, to arrest, to begin to acknowledge the activities and the guilt of people living in this country, literally under the protection of the United States government.
The right-wing Miami community are up in arms over the arrest of Alvarez, with some elements even red-baiting Washington. Miguel Saavedra, the leader of one Cuban extremist exile group, Vigilia Mambisa, said that, quote, "Every time Castro complains about something, this government does whatever they have to do so that he doesn't get mad." A strange turn of events, say Cubans here. In Havana for Free Speech Radio, I'm Joseph Muti.
Pakistan says that international donors have pledged $5.4 billion to help the country recover from last month's devastating earthquake. The pledges come largely as a result of an international donors' conference in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad towards the weekend. Pakistan has assured its donors of transparency in utilizing the funds, and representatives of most of the donor countries visited the quake-hit areas of Pakistan before meeting. The official death toll in last month's devastating quake has passed 75,000 people, while the UN fears an outburst of epidemics in the region. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
Delegates from 50 countries took part in the International Donors Conference in Islamabad this weekend, with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan criticizing what he called the weak response of the donors to the UN appeal. Prior to the conference, Annan remarked that $5.2 billion requested by Pakistan was not enough for the necessary rehabilitation efforts in Pakistan. Although, at the end of the conference, Pakistan was happy to get the pledges of $5.4 billion, mostly in the form of soft loans carrying lower interest rates and longer repay periods. The United Nations has also raised concerns about the health hazards in the aftermath of the quake. A United Nations Environment Programme official, Shafkat Kakakal, said on Sunday that the quake caused severe impact on natural resources, including deforestation, destruction of grazing places for animals, soil erosion, water contamination, and outbursts of lakes. He said that debris and waste left uncleared since the earthquake could become toxic and pose serious health dangers. Exposure to cold winters is also a serious concern of the aid workers in the affected areas. Hilal Ahmed Bhatt of Save the Children has been in Uri in Indian Amritsar, Kashmir since the October 8 quake.
The major health issues at Uri are primarily where the problem is like pneumonia and then diarrhea, which is generally found among the children who are exposed to extreme cold. This is number one. And then number two, we have the problems like children and women and also other vulnerable groups of people. They are still, some of them are still in shock, especially those who have lost one or other members of their families. They are still in shock.
The earthquake has also altered the environment at many places. At Sultan Daki in Uri, a new stream appeared after the October 8 quake. Tests carried out on its waters found it highly contaminated.
There was a situation where the people were, they were forced to use that water at one or other time because earlier the people used to get water from pipe drinking water scheme in the area, but the October 8 earthquake completely broke these pipes, which led to the unavailability of drinking water in the area. The people were in a way forced to drink the water which was available in that particular stream and which was really very dangerous.
A report prepared jointly by the United Nations Environment Programme and Pakistan's Ministry of Environment says a total of $22 million is required for the recovery of the depleted environment in Pakistan's earthquake-hit areas in the next 18 months. It will include short- and long-term recovery measures to mitigate the impact as well as to prevent further depletion of life-protecting ecosystems. And in between, there has been some progress on political front. After some delay, civilian movements across the line of control in Kashmir have finally begun. On Saturday, 24 people from Indian-administered Kashmir crossed into Pakistan-administered Kashmir at Titwal. Gul Hassan Shah was one among them.
I am very happy that India and Pakistan have taken this step. It is a good step. It should be permanent so that the divided people can cross every day and meet forever. After 58 years, today I will be seeing my cousins.
As a humanitarian measure, India and Pakistan had agreed last month to allow Kashmiris across the heavily militarized ceasefire line visit each other in the aftermath of the quake. The movement will be allowed twice a month on 5 designated points along the line of control. However, there are voices for making this travel easier. Mirwais Umar Farooq is the chairman of the moderate faction of Separatist Alliance All Parties Hurriyat Conference.
It's a very complicated process. I mean, you can't imagine a person in Titwal or Uri or in Poonch that he'll have to come to Srinagar and apply formally here and go to the passport office and get the clearance from the agencies, from the police, from the CID. It's a very long-drawn process. It's not helping that feeling which was basically behind the opening up of these lines. I think, you know, it should be a simple process, and we have suggested that identity card or state subject certificate is the best way to let people come and go.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan.
At least 3,000 supporters gathered at the 14-acre South Central Farmers Space last night to attend a free concert featuring Chicano and Mexican musicians organized in solidarity with the 350 families who work vegetable and fruit plots on the land, which is surrounded by South Central's train tracks and warehouses. A land dispute at 41st and Alameda has pitted the farmers against lawyer and developer Ralph Horowitz, who is waiting to take final possession of the land that was once bought from him under eminent domain by the city, but was sold back to him in 2003. Horowitz plans to convert it to what farmers call another unnecessary warehouse in an area that sorely lacks green space and is a vital place for community gathering. People Without Borders' Kelly Barnes files this report.
The benefit concert featured performances by former Rage Against the Machine lead singer Zach De La Rocha, Kid Sal, Los Cojolites, and others. The crowd included an overwhelming majority of first-time visitors to the community green space, a testament to the community-building efforts of the South Central farmers and their supporters. Pierre Junsi is a local activist with Access of Justice, a nonprofit focused on bringing together musicians and grassroots activists.
A friend of mine told me about Quetzal and Zach De La Rocha playing tonight, and then from there I learned about what this benefit show is about. And me being an activist here in LA and working with other organizations made me want to come out and support.
During the benefit, concertgoers were treated to freshly picked food with crops not normally found in stores, prepared by the farmers in traditional recipes. Tears well up in one farmer's eyes, Fidela Delgado, as she describes what it's like to tend her farm as the land dispute heats up.
Por lo regular, mira, yo estoy en elote cuando estoy sola, platico con mis plantas.
Normally, I talk to my plants. My husband must think I'm crazy because I'm there talking to myself out loud to the plants. But now when I see them so pretty, at the same time I feel sad. Sad because I don't know what's going to happen. But right now, to cultivate, it doesn't matter. I still cultivate. I still tend to them. I still take care of them.
Another concert goer waits patiently in a line that snakes around the block. Associated with Food Not Bombs and Mujeres Libres, she is taught at the farm.
I did this workshop with the kids and basically, you know, trying to keep everyone aware about, you know, what they see. And it's not only like, you know, just plants growing here, you know, it's them growing here too. You know, they have a t-shirt that says that.
Speaking to the potential of music to bring understanding, musician Ricardo Perry of Los Cojolites in Veracruz describes his task at hand.
I want to reach the people who are here tonight, the people listening to us, because we believe in the power of the word.
On November 18th, a hearing that purportedly would have finalized the sale to Horowitz was postponed yet again until early December. The farmers, working under threat of evacuation now for more than 2 years, feel their struggle is coming to a climax. 24-hour security vigils on the farm continue, and the farmers and their supporters focus on what Mayor Villaraigosa can do to halt the transfer. Marta Gonzalez is one of the musicians with Quetzal and also sitting in with Son de Mareda. She's a resident of Highland Park and grew up in Boyle Heights. Looking at the crowd at the benefit concert, the thousands of new faces, the show of media, and the upbeat energy of the night, she comments on the power dynamics of this land struggle.
The farmers are not being treated with dignity. I think that somebody needs to make a decision and everybody's kind of stalling. They don't want to be the ones to kind of pull the plug. And so it's a judge. The mayor has all the power to a certain extent to kind of get the rest of the city behind this project, but it's not happening. So I think people are just stalling.
Adding to the family campout and movie screenings taking place there recently, organizers with the farmers are looking to continue their struggle and stage additional events in their community garden. In Los Angeles for FSRN, I'm Kelly Barnes.
Native Americans from tribes around the country are gathering in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Thanksgiving Day, to honor all those who have died as a result of violence. And, as FSRN's Leslie Clark reports, to reveal an alternative view of the historical First Thanksgiving.
The sunrise ceremony is a traditional Lakota healing known as wiping away the tears. Gwen Packard is a Yahanktawan Dakota and one of the organizers of the event. She says, although the ceremony will be held on Thanksgiving Day, most indigenous peoples give thanks every day for things in their lives.
To have just one day out of the year is like churchianity. You just go to church for 1 hour a week, and that's the essence of some people's spirituality. I kind of see it the same symbolism with Thanksgiving.
The event will be held in front of a sculpture at the Albuquerque Museum depicting Don Juan de Oñate, the Spanish conquistador who founded the city 300 years ago. According to Myris Chino of Acoma, Oñate is also known as the man who cut off one foot of every Acoma Pueblo warrior who fought against the Spanish.
So what we're asking the people is that they bring a foot, and the foot really represents the actual butchery that the Spanish conquistador did to my people, the people of Acoma, and that we will create then another memorial to set at the foot of the conquistador memorial.
Organizers of the healing ceremony say they want Thanksgiving Day to be a day of truth.
Maybe there was one meal one time, I don't know. We'd certainly know what happened to all those indigenous people who met those first people that came here. They no longer exist, and those tribes have become extinct. So it's just kind of a little convenient story to create that Indians were welcoming of them and all this other stuff. It's all too convenient of a story for me.
Packard says the ceremony is for healing. She hopes that as people gather around the table with their families on Thanksgiving Day, they'll reflect on all those who have perished from violence and genocide. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. For more information or to get archives of this or any other newscast or documentary, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.